Genesis 25:19-26. This is the account of Abraham's son Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Padan Aram, and sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife, because she was barren. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first came out, was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out, with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. Now it's chapter 26:1-6. Now there was a famine in the land, besides the earlier famine of Abraham's time. And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of Philistines, in Gerar. The Lord appeared to Isaac and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land where I tell you to live. Stay in this land for a while, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands, and will confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and will give them all these lands, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my requirements, my commands, my decrees, and my laws." So Isaac stayed in Gerar. That's 23-25. From there he went to Beersheba. That night the Lord appeared to him and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bless you and will increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham." Isaac built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord. And there he pitched his tent, and there his servants dug a well.
Well, we're reflecting on Isaac, this great character from the Old Testament, one of the patriarchs. And I love that you're looking at this series, this season of the patriarchs. And together to reflect on Isaac, and I wonder if you could put the PowerPoint up and then I can click it forward. As we think about Isaac, and we're going to view his life through the prism of three moments. At least one of them has been captured in our reading, but I'm going to go back a little bit further. So we're going to reflect on life-changing choices. So what we can learn from Isaac about choices that we can make that may change the direction of our lives. Secondly, life-limiting failures. He and his family had, there were a number of sins that were repeated. For example, the next bit where he was told by God not to go to Egypt and stay, he ends up lying to Abimelech about who his wife is. Does that sound familiar? Something that Abraham did exactly the same. And we're going to find that there are some life-limiting failures in the family that are repeating sins, if you like. And then thirdly, we're going to think about life-giving spaces. What do we mean by that? Well, we'll find out as we go. So first of all, life-changing choices. Abraham, Isaac's father, has determined that it's time for Isaac to have a wife. And so he chooses a loyal, faithful, God-fearing servant to go to his family home to find a suitable partner for him. And so this servant travels many miles And when he arrives in the region, not knowing who he's going to meet, who he's going to bump into, tired and hungry, he sits by a well and he prays, God, give me success. And if someone comes and I ask them for water, may they provide water for me and may they prove to be of this family. And in fact, this prayer is even more specific, that even that a woman would come from that family, that she might be the woman that would be for Isaac to be a wife. Well, of course, the woman who comes is Rebekah. And he asks her for water, and she goes the extra mile, waters his camels, says, we've got food for you. We can make hospitality. Come to our family and be here with us. And on retelling the story then to her family, as they sit around a meal table together, at first the family agree that she can go and marry Isaac, as he tells them how God has led him. But the next day, as they're preparing to leave, the family get cold feet. They say, I'll let her stay for 10 days. You know, just give it a while. Rest here for a little bit longer. And the servant entreats them, come on, you agreed to this. So they say, well, we'll let her make her choice. And this is how it reads in Genesis 24. Well, they said, we'll call Rebekah and ask her what she thinks. So they called Rebekah. Are you willing to go with this man? They asked her. And she replied, yes, I will go. So they said goodbye to Rebekah and sent her away with Abraham's servant and his men. The woman who had been Rebekah's childhood nurse went along with her. They gave her this blessing as she parted. Our sister, may you become the mother of many millions. May your descendants be strong and conquer the cities of their enemies. Then Rebekah and her servant girls mounted the camels and followed the man. So Abraham's servant took Rebekah and went on his way. In a sense, the choice is not Isaac's choice, it's Rebekah's choice. And it is remarkable, and of course we live in a very modern world, and I'm a father of three daughters. And girls are very quick to point out to me how we can make men the hero of lots of stories, as they often are in the Bible. But of course there are many women who are heroes in the stories too. And Rebekah makes a significant life-changing choice. Life is full of choices, some big, many seemingly small. Of course, small choices too can drastically change the direction of your life. You'll sadly recognize that photograph, though you may not recognize the name on the screen, the horrific events of 9/11. And aren't we living through difficult days again? When we were in London yesterday, the numbers of people who were in London, because it was a Saturday, was significant, but it was half-term holidays, so it was heaving. And there were 100,000 people protesting about the situation in Gaza and Palestine. I've never seen so many Palestinian flags. There are so many challenges in our world. Greer Epstein never took breaks. She was an executive director at Morgan Stanley, and she rarely left her office on the 67th floor because she never had time. But 20 minutes before 9 a.m., on the 11th of September in 2001, one of her buddies called and said, hey, how about not nipping downstairs for a cigarette? He wanted to talk about an upcoming work meeting. It was a calm day with clear blue skies, the most beautiful day she'd ever seen from her view from the World Trade Center. Epstein figured, why not? While riding down the elevator, she felt a jolt, but ignored it since the elevators always acted strangely. When she stepped outside to light up her Benson and Hedges, she saw people frozen in place, their eyes fixed to the sky, paper raining down like chaotic confetti. As she stared at the fire and smoke billowing from a hole in the North Tower, she wondered, how do they fix something like that? That's when a plane threw through her office in the South Tower. A cigarette break saved her life. It's ironic, isn't it? Daniel Bellardinelli, a New York artist, backed out of a California trip that would have put him on Flight 93, the one which crashed in Pennsylvania. Every day, people make thousands of small, forgettable decisions. What to eat, when to take a break, which route to take to work or to Sladebrook. But for a handful of people on 9/11, those seemingly inconsequential decisions, stepping out for a smoke, dawdling on the commute to enjoy the morning, taking a different subway route, even waking up late because of the previous night's football game on TV, made all the difference between living and dying. We never know, in some ways, which choices will determine the direction of our lives. But there are some choices that we do know will determine the direction of our lives. Rebecca makes a life-changing choice. And I love the simplicity of her words. If we just go back. Well, we'll call her. Will you go? Are you willing to go with this man? And she says, yes, I will go. Yes, I will go. Years ago, I made a choice too that changed the direction of my life. Wasn't getting married to Rachel, that changed the direction of my life. Having children, that has radically changed the direction of my life. No, the biggest decision I made was when I was 7. And I knew that God loved me. And I knelt by my bedside as a little child and I invited Jesus to come in and save me. I invited him to take control of my life. I invited Christ to be my Savior and my Lord. Little did I know, age 7, what a transformation, what a difference, what a change of direction that would ultimately lead to. I wonder if you ever said in simplicity to Jesus, yes, I will go with this man. Yes, I'll follow him. Many choices are life-changing, marriage, education, work, but none is greater than answering the question about Jesus, will you go with this man? And so Rebecca is a wonderful example of faith in God. It's interesting, isn't it? Because the story, the testimony was told by Abraham's servant of how God had led them. But the family were all discouraging, saying, no, don't go. Wait a while. Give it 10 days. Are you sure you want to go? But she had heard the testimony of God's faithfulness, and she responded. It's interesting too, isn't it? And we're not going to deal with the section, but it was read to us in our reading that she asks God during her pregnancy, what's going on? And God explained it to her. Rebecca had a simple but clear faith in God. And her response is evidenced by this life-changing choice she made. But then the family, sadly, are clearly evident of life-limiting failures. We have read a little bit of this section from Genesis 22 to 26, and I'll put the verse on the screen in a moment. But Rebecca, first of all, of course, she struggled to get pregnant, and Isaac prayed. I'm sure they both prayed that the Lord would help her to conceive, that she would be able to have a family. And so Isaac prayed for a child, and God answered their prayers. And we had this reading, but the two children struggled with each other in her womb. So they went to ask the Lord about it. Why is this happening to me? We'll go on to the next bit. And when the time came to give birth, Rebecca discovered that she did indeed have twins. The first one was very red at birth and covered with thick hair like a fur coat, so they named him Esau. When the other twin was born with his hand grasping Esau's heel, they named him Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when the twins were born. Now, it all seems wonderful. You know, there's been this wrestling in her womb. The Lord tells her you've got twins. The Lord tells her that the firstborn's not going to be the greatest, that the greatest is going to be the secondborn, and that's Jacob. And his promise is going to follow Jacob's line rather than Esau's. And Rebecca understands all of that. But it seems to me that the failure in the family comes in the next couple of verses. Sorry, I just mention that. I'll read the next two verses to you, and then I'll move on to that. Listen to these verses, 27 and 28. As the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter. He was an outdoorsman, but Jacob had a quiet temperament, preferring to stay at home. Here it is. Isaac loved Esau because he enjoyed eating wild game Esau brought home. But Rebekah loved Jacob. See, God makes a promise to Rebekah. You'll have twins, two boys, they'll always struggle, but the younger will become the greater. Maybe you've been the favorite at home, or maybe you weren't the favorite. Maybe you look back and think, I don't think my parents had favorites. Well, that's a good home to grow up in. But it is amazing how many homes do have favorites. Or how many children grow up feeling they were either the favorite or they were definitely not the favorite. I think my mum and dad, by the way, we have to explain to our children, and I have three children and I'm the middle of three children, we have to explain to our children that we don't love them all the same. We love them all differently. We love them all equally in terms of how much we love them, but they are different. So you have to love them as they are to encourage them to go as they should go. That's difficult when you're a child to get your head around. I'm the middle of three, and I always giggle with my middle daughter, Anna, about how tough it is being the middle one. You see, the middle one gets the hand-me-downs. The youngest one doesn't have hand-me-downs because they're not good enough by the time they get to the third child. The eldest one gets everything new. The eldest one seems to be the favorite because they're the eldest. The youngest one seems to get away with everything because of the youngest. It's tough being the middle child. Amen. All right, okay, there we go. Okay, we got some agreement over here. At least that's how I perceived it. And so Anna and I giggle about that. And of course, I tell each of my children they're my favorite. Karen, you're my favorite eldest child. Anna, you're my favorite middle child. And Emily, you're my favorite youngest child. But let's be honest. Sadly, in our world, many homes grow up with terrible favoritism. The easier child is more loved. The tougher child is less loved. It's sometimes spoken aloud, but often it's simply obvious to any casual observer. There are lots of errors that parents make, and we all make in life. Sadly, some become patterns that determine the course of a family, even for generations to come. Perhaps you know families who are devastated by recurring themes of brokenness, or maybe you have come from such a family. And sadly, Isaac and Rebekah take sides. Isaac picks his favorite, Esau, because he's more like him. He likes to go hunting. He's sporty. He's outdoorsy. Rebekah, well, maybe because she heard what God said to her when the children were in the womb, she always favors Jacob. And sadly, between them, they set a course in their family that has repercussions for generations to come. You're coming soon to the story of Jacob. The story of Jacob is absolutely colored by favoritism. Absolutely colored by it. Now, the amazing thing in all of this is that God's grace continues to win through. And you can go back, of course, to the previous generation and see Abraham, how him and Sarah try and work out having a child and fulfilling God's promise. You know, it's never a really good idea to try and help God out with something he said he would do. And of course, they ended up having Ishmael. And I think you could probably trace some of the protests that are going on even in London yesterday back to the split between Ishmael and Isaac. Broken, divided world. Two counter families from the same root, both tracing their heritage to Abraham. What a mess. Because of not trusting God. Because of trying to do things that only God can do. And then because of choosing sides. Choosing favorites. And that's why I had this verse to come up on the screen. 1 Peter 1:17 was in my daily reading yesterday morning. Remember that the Heavenly Father to whom you pray has no favorites. Now, before anyone says, well, hang on, didn't God say to Rebekah that Jacob will be the greater? Yes, he did. Does that mean that God rejected Esau? No. God's love was equally to them both. God's love was strong for them both. In fact, did God reject Ishmael? No, Abraham rejected Ishmael. God made a promise to Hagar. I will look out for your son, and he will grow strong, and he will be a father of nations and of a kingdom. God is no man's favorite. He doesn't have favorites. He doesn't pick sides in that sense. You know, it is possible to break the cycle of brokenness by coming to God, who loves us completely. Maybe you need to confess a recurring or even a generational sin, something in your heart or your family, and discover the freedom that God can bring. Sadly, Isaac and Rebekah carried on a family tradition of favorites that would lead to devastation for Jacob as he lost, at least for in his own heart for many years, Joseph, and wasn't prepared to lose Benjamin as he was the new favorite on the block. And then finally, life-giving spaces. Life-giving spaces. Isaac has struggled to find a place of his own. Conflict seems to follow him around wherever he goes. And we didn't read this section, but it was around some of the verses that we looked at in chapter 26. Wherever he digs a well, and a well is a marker that you're going to set up camp, that you're going to pitch your tent, that you're going to live there for a season or even longer, maybe even make a permanent home. Wherever Isaac digs a well, there's a dispute with the neighbors. You ever have trouble with your neighbors? Well, he had trouble with his neighbors over the well digging business. And wells were fundamental, of course, to life and to prosperity. There was trouble, and he was always forced to move on. So we read this in Genesis 26, verses 22 to 25. Abandoning that well, Isaac moved on and dug another one. This time there was no dispute over it. So Isaac named the place Rehoboth, which means open space. For he said, at last the Lord has created enough space for us to prosper in this land. From there, Isaac moved to Beersheba, where the Lord appeared to him on the night of his arrival. I am the God of your father Abraham, he said. Do not be afraid. For I am with you and I will bless you. I will multiply your descendants and they will become a great nation. I will do this because of my promise to Abraham, my servant. Then Isaac built an altar there and worshipped the Lord. He set up his camp at that place and his servants dug another well. We're all looking for somewhere we can call home, aren't we? I don't know if you feel like that. Have you ever been somewhere and you just weren't made to feel at home? You know, people say to us, make yourself at home. I wonder what you mean when you say that, or what others have meant by it when they've said it to you. If when I was young and single before I was married, if someone had said to me, make yourself at home, I don't think they would have been too pleased by the state of the place after a couple of days. You know, it took me a week to pile enough dishes to feel it was worth washing them up. You know, I'm not like that now, but my wife's trained me now, you see. But when people said, make yourself at home, what did they mean? Well, we try and explain that when we have people come and stay to us, make yourself at home. We want them to feel that our home is their home. And therefore, we say, look, here are the cupboards, that's where the breakfast cereals are, that's where the bread is, that's the tea and coffee, this is how to use the coffee machine, and it's yours. You use it. I'll often pull out a mug and say, just don't use that one. That's my Arsenal mug. My daughter's bought for me. But apart from that, make yourself at home. What's mine is yours. Rachel and I, when we moved to Melksham, and we've made that our home, but we had this sense in our heart when we bought our house that it wasn't our forever home. Now, that's true in possibly two ways. I mean, on one level, we're now both in our 50s. Rachel turned 50. She won't thank me for saying it, but it's not been recorded. She won't listen back to it anyway. As it's me preaching, she'll not listen to it again. But now we're in our 50s, but we still feel there may be another season. If the Lord spares us, and of course none of us know, but if the Lord spares us, there may still be another season of whatever it might be. I don't know, I'm 55. I know, it's not that old. Did you boo? Yeah, okay. I know, some people say you're still young. Well, I guess I would like to think that someone else may take on the lead role of counties maybe by the time I'm 60. I don't know, but I kind of feel it would be great to have a younger person step in and take that role on. And if I was doing it at 60, I'd have been doing the role 12 years, which I think is plenty long enough. But maybe God's got something else for us. Now, we're not yearning for it. We're fully invested where we are and at the church at Queensway Chapel. But we have this sense that there may be another move in time, another ministry. Who knows where? Who knows when? But also it's true that it's not our forever home, because this world's not our home. It's not our home, brothers and sisters. And as we look at this world unfolding in tragedy and strife and war and fear and famine and brokenness and refugee crisis and wave after wave of people displaced and homeless, this world is not our home. We are pilgrims here. In fact, the Bible uses the word aliens. We're aliens here. Sure, we need to be at home. We need to make this our home in the sense that we want to transform this world. We want to see His kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. But we know that ultimately His kingdom's fulfillment is waiting a coming day when Jesus comes again. And when Jesus returns, He will make all things new. What a day that's going to be. In 1 Peter that I read, where God doesn't have favorites, Peter says to purify ourselves with this hope, and it's the hope of the coming day of salvation. It's the completeness. You know, we know that we're saved because of what Jesus accomplished on the cross and because of His resurrection. We know that trusting in Him saves us, but we've just been praying for people who are ill and struggling and in pain. And we do believe in a God of healing, but, you know, one out of every one person dies. It's a high statistic. It's a racing certainty that if the Lord doesn't come, it will come to you and I both. But my hope's not in this world. My hope's in another world. There is a day that we're all waiting for. And I hope you're waiting for it. And I want to encourage you. I want to encourage you that there is a home for you. I used to sing, and I was banned from singing. We used to have United Beach Mission come to Bangor, seaside town in Northern Ireland, where I grew up. And UBM used to come every year for their summer mission. And we had to have a talent competition. And I won it at least a couple of times singing, "I've Got a Home in Glory Land." And, you know, when you're five, you're cute when you sing it, you know. "I've got a home in glory land that outshines the sun way beyond the blue." I believed it then, and I believe it now. There is a place. There is a place. What a wonderful place. Isaac yearned for a place for his growing family. It's interesting, isn't it? The writer to the Hebrews says that when Abraham was called to establish a nation, the writer to the Hebrews says he looked for a city, another city. He anticipated a later city whose builder and maker was God. Abraham saw into the future and he trusted God for what God had for him beyond this life, beyond this world. Isaac yearned for a place for his growing family. I love that when he found it, he called it Rehoboth. Open space. Oh, at last I can breathe. I've got to be honest, however much we want people to feel at home in our house, we breathe a sigh of relief when they go. And however much they want me to feel at home in their house, they and I breathe a sigh of relief when I go. It's just human nature. We love to just kick our shoes off, put our feet up, and relax and say, isn't it good to be home? I guess, like me, you enjoy holidays, but I must admit, one of the joys about holiday is that moment when you get home. You've heard the story, perhaps, of the missionary who was traveling on a ship back to the United States after spending many years in Africa. And when he arrived at the dockside, there was a fanfare and flags and a band. And it turned out that the president of the United States had been traveling back from an overseas trip, first class. And, of course, he hadn't seen the president at all. He didn't know the president was on the ship. And everybody had to wait as they watched the president disembark the ship. The band welcomed him, a huge banner saying, "Welcome home, Mr. President," after a long overseas trip, back in the days when all of that was done by sea. And the missionary thought to himself, "Where's my welcome party? No one there to greet him. Had to find his way across New York and find a cheap night somewhere." And he prayed that night, "Lord, why, after all I've been doing for 30 years in Africa, has no one been here to welcome me and say, welcome home?" And he said, "I heard the Lord say to me, that's because you're not home yet. You're not home yet." Folks, it's right to make this world our home on one level, but we will never be totally satisfied here. C.S. Lewis said, "If there are yearnings in our heart that cannot be fully fulfilled here, it would suggest that our heart is made for somewhere else." And that's a great thing just to reflect on. I believe that we're all yearning for this open space, somewhere to breathe, somewhere to live at peace, somewhere to call home. I think we're all yearning for that too. God invites us to discover a home in Him, a place of rest, of space, of peace, of joy. Jesus says in Matthew 11, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Let me teach you, because I'm humble and gentle in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy to bear, and the burden I give you is light." You know, when we come to Jesus, in one sense, we're discovering that we're home. Coming to Jesus, even in this world, is discovering that there is somewhere for us. Someone who loves us. Someone who says, "Be at peace with me." God can give us peace here, but its ultimate fulfillment is in a coming day. Paul writes, "So we are always confident, even though we know that as long as we live in these bodies, we are not at home with the Lord. For we live by believing and not by seeing. Yes, we are fully confident. We would rather be away from these earthly bodies, for then we will be at home with the Lord." I think as I get a little bit older, I am more willing to look forward to that day. When you're young, you've got so many plans and dreams and hopes and aspirations. And that's good. We shouldn't rob young people of their plans and dreams and hopes and aspirations. And we should encourage them. But the greatest hope, the greatest aspiration, is to know Him and to be with Him one day. And Paul says, that is when I will be at home with the Lord. So, in conclusion, what a story, the life of Isaac. And what a window it gives us into the human heart with its brokenness, into some of the great ways in which we can honour God by making good choices, just as Rebecca did. It points us to Jesus, the life of Isaac, the one who calls us to follow Him, the one who frees us from sinful choices, can forgive us and bring new life to us, and the one who ultimately has prepared a home for each of us to live in. I'm going